This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Richard Wollstonecroft. We're going to be discussing MUF, the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, and we have some exciting news about an upcoming event there involving us. So, and I'm also joined here with Matthew Pegas, and Matthew and I worked on a little project called Supply.
Yes, great to be here, Robert.
Which is playing at the 19th Melbourne Underground Film Festival, which you can check out at the website www.muff19.com.
So, Richard, when is the official opening for MUF this month, the first screening?
October 26th, in 2 weeks from this Friday. We open with a great film from an Australian filmmaker, though, who moved to America. His name is Mark Savage, and his new film, Purgatory Road, starring Gary Karns, opens the festival, and it's a really great opening. And the short called 5 o'clock.
You were basically the founder of MUF.
I did found the festival. I'm an independent filmmaker. I made my first film, Bloodlust, in 1990 with a local Australian filmmaker by the name of John Hewitt, who's a great Australian filmmaker who's gone on to make about 6 or 7 features. He recently remade the film Turkey Shoot with producer Anthony Ganane and line producer David Lightfoot, and I was the second unit director on that film. So we're old friends, and we made our first feature together. He was, I think, 30, 31 at the time, and I was 21, so I started pretty young.
When did you start the film festival, and can you talk about the process and setting it up?
Sure. I started the Melbourne Underground Film Festival in 2000. Give you a little prehistory. In 1992, I started a very famous nightclub in Australia called the Hellfire Club, and it was reasonably financially successful. I ran it for about 10 years. And in the late 90s, it was kind of winding down a little bit, and I also wanted to get out of the nightclub scene. And obviously, I'd made the film Pearls Before Swine that many of you within the New Right community might know, starring Boyd Rice and Douglas P. from Death in June. And I'd made that film, and I'd made Bloodlust before that, and I wanted to go back to my film interest. I found running clubs enjoyable, but I thought, you know, I'd done pretty well out of it, and I was turning 30, and I thought, well, now's the time to really focus on my film career. So my film Pearls Before Swine, starring Boyd, had been rejected by the Melbourne International Film Festival, even though it had been selected to the Stockholm International Film Festival, the Pusan Fantastic Film Festival in Korea, the Hihik Film Festival, Sitges Film Festival in Spain. It had played about 5 or 6 major festivals. And I thought, well, why is it not being played in the city it was shot in, you know? So I wrote this outraged email to an internet film zine at the time called Filmnet, and I said, look, I think it's a disgrace that they're not playing this, you know, low-budget genre film, and I think they should be supporting these kind of films. And about 30 or 40 filmmakers responded to me, and they all said, you know, yeah, look, I made this lesbian vampire film, and I made this, I made this science fiction film, and I made this really weird transgressive political thing, and they all sounded great, all these projects. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. I just said to everybody who wrote to me, you're all accepted. So there was about 10 features and about, I don't know, 30 shorts. I said, you're all in. Just send me your films and I'll play them and I'll found a film festival. And that was the Melbourne Underground Film Festival number one. And some of the filmmakers who sent me their films and wrote to me directly were James Wan, who went on to create the Saw franchise, which is the greatest horror franchise in cinema history. Greg McLean, who made the film Wolf Creek. Patrick Hughes, who went on to recently make the film The Expendables, and a new film with Samuel L. Jackson. I can't remember its name. I think it's called The Assassin's Hitman or something with an assassin. I can't remember its exact title, but it was a fun film. And a whole bunch of other very talented filmmakers.
What about Alex Proyas?
Alex Proyas, no, his film wasn't in MUF 1. He was already reasonably established in 2000. He'd recently, he'd made Dark City. I think he was planning Garage Days around that time. And he was reasonably well established, though I think he'd been aware of MUF, and he was a guest of MUF last year, and he gave a masterclass, which you can watch online. So if you look up Alex Proyas Masterclass, you can see the live show that we did. That was pretty much a full house, and a lot of fun last year.
Obviously, the film festival is pretty underground, as the name would suggest, but you've had some pretty famous guests over the years. I saw on Bret Easton Ellis and Paul Schrader and some others.
Well, Paul Schrader wasn't a guest. Bret Easton Ellis was. We had Lloyd Kaufman from Troma. We had William Lustig. We had Jim Van Beber. We had Bruce LaBruce, the LBGT filmmaker. We've discovered about 5 or 10 filmmakers who've gone on to make really amazing and they've become quite commercially successful. We discovered Scott Ryan, who's got that new TV show. I think it's on Netflix or FX in America, called Mr. In Between. We discovered his film called The Magician. This is quite a hit show at the moment. I even think in America it's a hit show. So I highly recommend that too. He's a MUF alumni. You know, basically, the film festival in the world that played the work of a lot of these Australian filmmakers I mentioned, Scott Ryan, James Wan, Patrick Hughes, the Spearig brothers, Greg McLean, the first film festival in the world to play the work of these filmmakers is the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. Now, I don't know how many filmmakers can say that. I mean, why can't the Melbourne International Film Festival say that? That has a budget of around $1 million, and it basically excludes the greatest talent. And most of these filmmakers were, at the beginnings of their career, rejected by these festivals. And, of course, the local Australian film industry doesn't like to share that news, but I don't mind sharing it, which points out the value of a festival like the Melbourne Underground Film Festival.
Yeah, because you basically, if you're going to be a great film filmmaker, you have to first get exposure to your films, and I guess they have this mentality that everyone has to have like the top level of fame first, but it's really important to get a lot of these films out there, and that's basically what you're doing.
And that was what was great about having Alex Proyas down, because even though he'd worked, he'd made multi-million dollar features, he made iRobot starring Will Smith. I mean, even though he'd worked at the highest level of Hollywood that there is, he worked with Nicolas Cage, and a whole number of other major stars in Hollywood, he still had a kind of underground spirit a little. And his first film, Spirits of the Clouds, Gremlins of the Sky, he was down in Melbourne at the same time. He was remastering that to be released on Blu-ray and DVD in Australia through Umbrella Entertainment. That's now come out, and that's brilliant. That's a one-hour feature that he made in the late 80s, which I highly recommend. You can order it online, and I don't know if it's out in America, but it's a really amazing film. But it's definitely a low-budget genre film. I think this is how people begin, and this is why I think MUF is important. It's been a great platform for many filmmakers, and many filmmakers who even weren't launched at MUF have respected the festival and come and spoke at it. And you know, at the moment, we're talking to Michael Tolkien about maybe being a guest at its sister festival, not at MUF this year, but a festival that's coming up called the Oz International Film Festival, that's run by Frank Housen, who's the festival patron of MUF. So MUF's sort of given birth, in a sense, to a second festival that's going to be run by Frank Housen. So and at the moment, we're talking to Michael Tolkien about being a guest there. So it's a lot of exciting things happening. We're really at the centre and the matrix of, you know, what's happening in local Australian cinema. And, of course, the funding bodies hate that because they don't fund the festival. I mean, it's one of the few film festivals that they don't fund. It doesn't cost the taxpayer a cent, and it's been running for nearly 20 years now. They don't know how it's done.
Curious how the Bret Easton Ellis connection came about, because I'm a big fan, and he also represents someone who's fairly well-connected in Hollywood, fairly up there, but also really keeps an underground attitude about things. I listen to his podcast a lot.
I can tell you about that. I might even have a chat to him. Maybe I'll try and get him on, you know, on one of your shows if you'll do a podcast, because I know he does his own podcast, which is excellent. Look, I made a film called The Beautiful and Damned, and originally I wanted to adapt a novel by Bret Easton Ellis. But obviously, licensing one of his books would cost, I don't know what it would cost, but it would cost, you know, a fair amount of money, I imagine. The first three novels of F. Scott Fitzgerald were in the public domain, including The Beautiful and Damned. And I read that, and it kind of struck me as a kind of like a Bret Easton Ellis novel. Yeah. But written in the 1920s. So I thought, why don't I move it in time from the 20s? And I'll, instead of alcoholism and the wildlife of the 20s, I'll move it to sort of now and add drugs and other kind of activity. And then I dedicated it to Bret Easton Ellis. And we had a mutual friend in Hollywood, and he gave me his email, and I sent him the film and told him I'd dedicated it to him. And then he said, well, why don't we have lunch? So we caught up. We became friendly. We kind of got along at the first lunch. I actually wrote an article online about our first meeting, and then we did an interview for Richardson magazine, which is a really in-depth interview, which was the kind of Los Angeles-based kind of classy porn magazine run by Andrew Richardson, who's right, one of the coolest people in New York. He's a friend of, what's the name of the other photographer called Richardson? They do fashion photography, and they're part of that kind of jet set crowd in New York. So, you know, basically I did this giant interview with him, and I think that interview is available online at CBS because we syndicated it locally in CBS, which is like, sorry, SBS, which is like the multicultural station in Australia. They bought the article, so that was good.
Nice.
Richard, this is going to be the premiere of our first big film, Supply. Richard, what were your initial reactions to watching Supply?
Well, I was very impressed. I see a lot of films, you know. I mean, we had a huge year this year of entries, so I was very impressed with what you're doing, and also I'm aware of Luke Ford, and I thought it had an interesting lo-fi aesthetic, and obviously I've been aware of your podcasts, and so when I saw that you had a new feature out, I thought, well, I've really got to play this. And, you know, really last year with this whole controversy, you know, my interest in new right politics was brought up, and so I don't feel ashamed. I don't feel like I have to hide it so much anymore. So I put your film on at the same time with Steve Bannon's new work, which is Trump at War, and Lauren Southern's film, Farmland. So it's basically a triple feature in a way. So you're going to be starting off that day. There probably will be a few protests on that day, no doubt. But hopefully they won't start for your film, you know.
So it'll be Bannon's, Trump at War, Laura Southern's, Farmlands, and then Supply.
Yeah,
well, actually, the way around. It's going to be Supply, and then Bannon, and then Lauren Southern. So, you know, you started off, mate. You kicked the ball off.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty big names for sharing the screen with.
So one will be about political warfare, one will be about violent warfare, and one will be about a psychological inner torment.
Exactly. And I think that's a great triple feature, and I'm really quite delighted. And I wish you were here for closing night, you know, because you know, that's when we give out the Muff Awards. So if you do well, maybe we'll Skype you in.
Oh, great.
Well, yeah, that would be excellent. So are Bannon and Southern going to be there?
Well, I don't think Steve Bannon will be, but we are in contact with Team Bannon, and I've sent them the catalogue, and they have been quite friendly and quite open towards screening the film at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. I believe Steve Bannon's been informed that the film is playing, so that's great news. We're going to try and Skype him in to do a video introduction, and Team Southern, she's making her new documentary. When I first contacted them, they considered possibly flying in for it. They haven't exactly said what they're going to do. There's a possibility she could fly in for the screening and the closing night, but we'll wait and see. That probably won't happen, I'll say here, but if they decide to do it, it's a free country. It will certainly attract a lot of press, because last time she was in this country, they had to have a police cordon of around 100 people, so it's going to certainly change the dynamic of the event if that happens. But we'll wait and see what happens, and, you know, I mean, I don't know, I guess we'll have to, you know, broach that situation if she decides to come. But if she doesn't decide to come, I'm pretty sure that day is going to be basically a full house and, you know, a very popular screening, though there might be a few protests.
Do you have any comments on both Bannon's film and Southern's film, Farmlands?
I think Farmlands is excellent. I was very impressed with her skill as a documentarian. Last year we gave Best Film to a female filmmaker who made a film called... slipped my mind. Oh, well, I'll come back to that in a minute. A Brilliant Genocide by Ebony Butler. She was an amazing filmmaker who made a film about the whole, you know, civil war that's been going on in Uganda, and we gave that Best Film. And I thought Lauren Southern was another interesting documentary by a female filmmaker, and I was very happy to include it in the program. Of course, you know, both Bannon, your film, and Southern's have never had a festival berth in Australia, and the Melbourne Underground Film Festival is very proud to play these three films.
Plus, it's really important for us because we're just starting out. I mean, we have some upcoming projects, but this is our featured film.
Debut, exactly. Well, you know,
our debut.
when you're wonderfully successful and rich in Hollywood, you know, you're going to have me saying you're a Muff alumni.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's it. You're going to have that tag.
Yeah, we're getting our supply.
Yeah, we'll see where this
that's
goes.
That's it, the supply. I like that term. I like the name, and I've even started using the word supply.
It's a nifty little term.
It is, yeah. To people who are obsessed with... I mean, look, I probably get supply off my own Facebook page because I'm notoriously always posting rubbish there. So.
Well, I'm really glad that you like the film. Obviously, it is extraordinarily low budget. I pretty much just shot it on my Nikon digital camera. And that
no,
was
I love that.
It,
that's the future of cinema. That's
what
the future
do you
of cinema.
Think about the whole beginning sequence? So there was the interview with Ford, but the whole the cinematographic style and the narrative of the whole little adventure that goes through in Beverly Hills.
I was very impressed with it. I thought it was a little bit like my own The Second Coming, you know, in the kind of lo-fi aesthetic of it. And I really liked that kind of aesthetic. So that impressed me immediately. I think, you know, a lot of filmmakers wait around till they get, you know, $1 million to make a film or at least $100,000 or something. But you can make a film for next to nothing. You know, I was very impressed by what you did with that. And, you know, that's definitely that kind of no-budget film in a way, you know, with that interesting aesthetic. I'm very impressed with. The closing night of this year's Melbourne Underground Film Festival is a guy by the name of Mike Redder. He made this brilliant film called Youth on the March, which is using a very much a lo-fi, low-budget aesthetic, and it's really an amazing work of art. He's one of the hot new Australian indie filmmakers, so he's got a really great network of indie filmmakers who are coming along to MUFF this year, and he's going to be a guest of the festival. He's down from South Australia. So I think, you know, again, MUFF is continuing to remain at the heart of this, you know, kind of burgeoning revolution, both locally and overseas. Even though the social justice warriors wanted me out of the festival, you know, but here I am, still doing it.
Well, yeah, there's been that big political controversy this year. So is there pretty much a political mix? So are there people involved who are much more liberal, and then some people with more right wing or politically incorrect views? Like, how do people get along with MUFF?
You know, I'll explain that. I'll explain what happened last year. I mean, basically, we had a very successful MUFF with Alex Proyas last year. It was one of our best festivals. It was a big success. And then about 2 weeks later, there was the issue of the yes and no vote. It was in relation to gay marriage. And I'm not particularly opposed to gay marriage at all, really. But I noticed that every single person within the arts community was arguing for the yes. And I just have a contrarian nature in me. So without even particularly being a yes supporter, being a no supporter, I decided to argue the no point. And I had a few gay friends, and some of them even supported no. So we had a few political discussions. Most of them were polite. I was very polite, and I was just making the case for no, not necessarily on the issue itself, but on the fact that, you know, once this thing, you know, it's a bit of a slippery slope. It's going to be taught in schools. It's going to be, like, propagandized. I don't have a problem with gay marriage as such, but I had concerns along what was called the slippery slope argument. So essentially I made that argument. I wasn't particularly committed to it, but I just made that argument. And then on the day that Yes won, I posted, you know what a black pill post is. That the left version of a black pill post is the day when Trump won. Everyone wrote, the world is ending. This is the worst thing to ever happen to humanity. And, of course, it's all hyperbolic bullshit. Even a lot of left-wingers know that now. And I did this kind of outrage kind of thing. And basically, I'd been out drinking with friends the night before. I woke up with a hangover and a filthy mood. And so I wrote this kind of black pill post about, you know, the yes vote winning. I didn't even particularly mean most of the things I said. Anyway, someone screenshotted it and it went viral within the local film community. And then there was a bit of an outrage for about a week, you know, people calling for my resignation and stuff. I did apologize about 2 or 3 days later. I had some gay friends in the community who were a little bit upset. But the surprising thing, and this I should say this, a lot of my friends in the gay community rang me up about 2 or 3 days into the controversy, and they weren't to tell me off. They were just to like, are you okay, Rich? You know, this is kind of awful what's happening to you. And, like, you know, they were calling me, like, as concerned friends. And, of course, a few of them made kind of arch jokes, like, oh, you put your foot in it now, lovey, and things like this. And I go, well, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I used to run the health club. I have a lot of gay friends from when I used to run nightclubs. I've always been very friendly to the gay community.
Excellent homoerotic S&M in your film Pearls Before Swine.
Exactly. The last thing I am is homophobic. And people who know me know this. And But I don't know. It just went out of proportion. It wasn't really the gay community attacking me, which is, again, my point about the globalists or the social justice warriors taking over someone else's politics and then using it for their own ends of division and stuff. So anyway, look, this sort of blew up a bit. And then at the time, I considered putting the festival patron, Frank Housen, in charge of the festival. Frank said he would do it. And then we kind of like let things cool down. And at our first meeting, Frank and I sat down, and Frank kind of spoke about what he'd like to do. And we didn't completely see eye to eye. I wanted to keep the festival very much anti-political correctness. And what Frank wanted to do was a little bit more political correct. So I thought, well, okay. You know, and Frank and I were on the same page. He said, look, I'll start my own festival, and you continue to run Muff, and, you know, I'll support you, and you can support me if you like. So we're on that same page a bit. And so he's doing a film called the Oz International Film Festival 1 month after Muff. And that's going to probably be similar to Muff in some ways, but it's going to have his own vision, which I think is great, you know. And I think it's a win-win. You know, that way, you know, two festivals are born, and to quote Chairman Mao, may a thousand flowers bloom.
Yeah, for sure. So the overall theme, if there is a political angle to Muff, it's not necessarily right-wing, but it's anti-censorship, anti-political correctness, freedom of speech.
Radical free speech festival. I was exactly in Bali. I did this interview with Mike Retta, this really amazing new independent filmmaker, on his website. You can look at it online. Just Google my name and Mike Retta. It'll come up. And we did this interview where I unresigned because I was considering resigning for a year and coming back to the festival and letting Frank run it for a year or two. But I decided, as I said at this meeting with Frank, he was going to do his thing and I was going to do mine. And I said, I'm not going to resign. I'll leave my apology stand because I did upset a few friends. And, you know, I did think that particular post was a bit over the top, and it was not something I wanted shared virally, even though it was. You know, so I let the apology stand, but I unresigned. And, you know, I just had a very clear message to people from the social justice warriors who consider themselves kind of neo-McCarthyists, that when someone says something not politically correct, they should lose their job, or, you know, they conduct this kind of witch hunt or neo-McCarthyist attack upon. And I've got a clear message to these people, which is basically, you know, to get fucked.
Yeah, I noticed in the director's statement, you kind of talked about how people with sort of new right or alt-right perspectives are sort of the new counterculture. So it's interesting that you bring up McCarthyism because, I mean, obviously in the mid-century 1900s, you know, it was anti-communism was the kind of the Red Scare at that time. But it does kind of feel like we're living in an era nowadays where the same tactics and the same pressures are being put on people with conservative points of view.
Well, I have a number of friends who are kind of Marxists, and who I wouldn't call them new left, I call them old left. They're interested in, like, you know, raising the wages of working class people in their countries, and they're interested in you know, limiting the way that large corporations and billionaires can exploit people. And I've even been quite sympathetic to some of that. I don't want to go like full Stalin or Mao on people, but like I can understand the element of the left wing that wants to, you know, lift the standard of living to the working class and to use the fantastic energies of capitalism and to just tax it a little bit more at the higher end, not the middle class, not at the working class, but at the very highest end, the major corporations.
Matthew,
couldn't you say, yeah, like, all these different themes we're talking about relate to that concept of the alt center?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's what we advocate on Robert's show most of the time.
I mean, Matthew, if you want to give Richard, like, a brief introduction of how you would describe the concept, go for it.
Of alt center? I mean, I think there's different angles you could go, but it's basically like a moderate third positionism. Third positionism being sort of fusion between fascism and communism. This would be the moderate version of that, so sort of more socially nationalistic, but also economically populist.
Well, I agree with that. And, for example, Steve Bannon has expressed some of those ideas, and I'm quite sympathetic to those ideas.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely kind of what
so economic nationalism definitely interests me. And, you know, if I was to critique the right wing of politics, I would say, for example, cultural Marxism to me is how the left is being cucked out by the globalist elite. Now, I would say economic libertarianism is how the right wing has been cucked out by the globalists.
Because, yeah, you know, I would agree. Yeah.
Being in favor of, you know, the greed of someone like Jeff Bezos to, like, you know, like, pay his staff like minimum wage, it's like, fuck off, you know? And the way that Trump is anti-outsourcing, where he says, yeah, go ahead and outsource your companies, but I'll place a tariff on you, you know, that will make your product so expensive that it's way too, you know, way better for you to keep the jobs in America. And I think that's a very smart move, and I think that's a very, it's almost left what is left in a way. So I'm quite sympathetic to that kind of dialogue. I don't worship the mega rich, but I don't wish to, you know, Cuba the economy. I think it's a dialectic, and I think what you're saying about the alt center, radical centrism, that's a term that I've used, and that's probably close to my politics. I would say I'm a radical centrist who maybe leans a little to the new right and is interested in all this dialogue, and is particularly interested in free speech, you know, and I can talk with a Marxist, and I think a lot of Marxists I've spoken to, and I have a couple who I can name, David Thrussell from the band Snog, he's quite left in some ways, but we're often on the same page about things, and he's deeply suspicious about the way mainstream media is pushing the left-wing agenda. He understands, as a Marxist, that the bourgeois elite, which is essentially the same concept as the globalist elite, when they are pushing your politics, something's gone wrong, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
he believed in global warming until mainstream media started pushing it. And then he said, well, that's bullshit, obviously, you know what I mean? So, like, it's an interesting way to look at it. I think a Marxist always questions, you know, the mega elite power structure. And I think the left, the new left, has stopped doing that. And this is why they're all so confused. They're all screaming and yelling because they've actually lost contact with their true leftist politics.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's something that's very visible.
Oh, I'm right. Absolutely right.
Richard and I, we did actually recorded a podcast on his film, Pearls Before Swine. Matthew, you watched that. Do you want to offer your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I love Pearls Before Swine. I've been a big Boyd Rice fan for long before I was even interested in the new right, actually, just as a fan of the post-punk kind of era of music. So that was obviously a treat to see Boyd. But more generally, just a great film that explores themes that I would say I very generally find interesting to be explored in film. I think, Richard, I saw a list of some of your favorite filmmakers at some point, which included Gaspar Noé, Kenneth Anger, Pasolini, yes. David Lynch, and that's pretty much my taste in film as well. This kind of exploration of also, I know American Psycho and A Clockwork Orange were big reference points for that film, which are two of my favorite films. So just exploring sexual dynamics and power dynamics in that way are pretty much what I go to cinema for a lot of the time.
You know, I think that's what we were doing, and it was a transgressive piece of cinema. In a sense, it predicted the alt-right in a funny kind of way. I mean, when we were making the film, we saw it as a kind of prophetic film that was sort of predicting that the world in, say, 10 to 20 years would sort of move to a kind of more right or even far-right kind of position. And that was sort of the background of the story that was going on. And it was set in a kind of G.J. Ballard way, in the near future kind of thing. And I think the film's been quite prophetic. I mean, obviously, the film's not perfect. It's a little bit what I would call Sophomore or whatever. It was my second feature, and I made it when I was 26, 27. I maybe was not as philosophically and astute as a filmmaker as I am now at that age, but I do think it's a lot of fun. Boyd Rice enjoys the film and often plays segments of it at his concerts. He remains a big supporter of the film, and you can order it through Solomon Distribution, which is a company that releases Death in June and some Boyd Rice material and Coil and others. Check that out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I watched Steve Bannon's new film today, Trump at War. Yeah, I don't know. I guess what I was going to ask about your take on sort of the state of the American populist right and the significance of Bannon as a figurehead. We kind of saw him move more towards European politics more recently, well, but I guess
he had that falling out with Trump, which I thought was very sad because I thought they went very well together. But I'm pretty sure that, you know, what we call the globalists or that Washington elite or in a Marxist perspective, the bourgeois elite was very adamant to split those two apart. I think they created a situation. I don't know how they did it, but they basically poisoned the well somehow between the two of them. It was through that book, Fire and Fury. Is that what it's called by that globalist who wrote that book?
Yeah, is it Tom Wolfe? Is that his name?
No, it wasn't Tom Wolfe, but it was some guy. Anyway, yeah. That book, you know, had a few quotes where Bannon was, you know, maybe a little overly critical of Trump, and that obviously created a rift, I think. And look, I'm sure he regrets talking to this guy because he made these comments off the record, which, of course, in this political climate, you know, nothing's off the record. So, you know, it was a deliberate attack upon their relationship, and it succeeded, I think. But I'm sure that behind the scenes they're probably still friendly. And obviously, with this new film, Bannon is definitely still blowing the Trump horn. Obviously, Bannon has gone to Europe to attempt to unite this kind of populist right movement. And that's one of the things, my own writings at Affirmative Right with Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki, the site that the site was originally founded by Richard Spencer, but they took it over about, I don't know, 5-10 years ago. Mm-hmm. That has always been my position, that this is an international movement, that it's something that affects every country. Obviously, I think something like the alt-right was originally very connected to just America, but I see this whole, you know, far-right populism, and I didn't agree with Richard Spencer the way he wanted to keep what's considered the alt-right at the more, let's say, the Daily Stormer end of things, the more radical end.
Yeah.
That was an extremely unwise and really stupid thing to
Absolutely.
Do.
But you're talking about how, like, with Charlottesville, all those people were kind of, they came in and that caused a lot of chaos.
Absolutely. If you're going to have a rally like that, do you really want to walk down the street carrying torches like Nazis, screaming Jews will not divide us? I mean, that's one of the most stupid things I've ever seen from anybody.
Oh, yeah.
if I would have dressed them in multicolored tracksuits and I would have had something like, you know, the elite will not divide us, and that, I mean, you would have got half the left-wing community backing us. You know what I mean? Like,
or something yeah. like the capitalists will not replace us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Bourgeois or something.
Disaster. Yeah.
I mean, there's been the argument that Richard Spencer is an agent of some sort. You know, what's it called? Controlled opposition. And I didn't believe that until, I mean, I still don't, really. I actually quite like Richard Spencer. I think I would get along with him, I think. And he's quite a smart guy, and I enjoy a lot of his podcasts. But really, mate, like, is that really... You know, like, now's the time. I mean, the movement's attracting, like, mass attention. It can achieve a kind of mass popularity. And if you intend to alienate people and alienate supporters from various sides of politics with this kind of theatrical, you know, like, 1488 stuff, it's like, I thought that was most unwise.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was an intentional decision on anyone's part, but that's definitely how it shook down. I mean, it's really a shame that alt-right has become synonymous with white nationalism.
With the theme of politics in our film Supply, originally we were actually debating about how political we wanted to make it, so we made the decision to kind of actually downplay the politics, or at least make the political theme much more implicit. So Supply, it's primarily about psychology, but you could definitely relate all these themes to dissident politics, so we do touch on that theme for sure, but it's not the primary focus. But that was originally a discussion Matt and I had.
Well, that's one of the reasons I liked it, because, you know, I mean, I think it touches on these issues, but I think that it's not, you know, I mean, it's just a lot more interesting, and it raises interesting issues, and it's more broad, and, you know, it's not, as I said, you know, the far right of the far right, you know what I mean? It's a kind of, you know, and I think it's an interesting topic, the relationship and your interest in Luke Ford, and even Luke Ford himself, you know, as a persona who probably not a lot of people outside of the New Right community know about. So I think it's all really fascinating.
And one thing that was fascinating, Luke said, is that he described himself as a mix matcher, where you have these eclectic interests. And I think it makes you a very fascinating person, but it can lead to tension and conflict in your life.
Yes, I think so. And I think, you know, my politics is often misunderstood, because I'm actually quite broad-minded on politics, and I'm not overtly dogmatic. I'm quite happy to sit down with people, even people who are social justice warriors. I used to get invited to many... I mean, obviously, most people in the film industry are of a kind of new left or social justice warrior. And I used to get... invited to many of their dinner parties. Catherine Devaney, for example, is a famous, you know, kind of what you call one of these new feminists. Some would call a feminazi, almost, that kind of. She's always denouncing men, and, you know. But she goes out with a friend of mine, Anthony Artman, and we used to have dinner parties together, and we always got along. And, you know, we would Catherine and I would have these great discussions that everybody would sit back and go, whoa, you know. But, like, we were always a bit good fun about it, you know. Until, I don't know. I think with the Trump victory, before then I was considered a novelty in the sense that my ideas seemed radical, but not really, you know, having any, you know. I think after the Trump and the Brexit thing, they began to think, hang on a minute, Richard's ideas are becoming mainstream. And then they began to stop inviting me and, you know, get
I think a similar thing has kind of happened. Well, I don't know. Boyd Rice has experienced this in his own life. I have no idea. But I mean, there was apocalypse culture. There was, there's that scene in the 90s where you could kind of explore some of these ideas, and people who are otherwise very left-wing would be down to do so, just as, you know, experiencing as a kind of fringe art. And I do think that has changed under Trump, where all of a sudden there's a much more of a crackdown. People are taking these things way more seriously.
No, I think with Boyd, too, and obviously I can't speak for Boyd's politics. Boyd has to do that himself, and he doesn't actually come out and, make, you know, at least recently. I know he's been attacked for his interest in, particularly for the way he dresses and the symbolism he uses. But he hasn't come out and said anything about Trump, as far as I'm aware of, and he has not made any comment on the alt-right that I know of. So, I do think he's slightly distanced himself from it, slightly, because I think he sees himself primarily as an artist and a musician. And that whether he actually agrees with these ideas or whether he is just using them as part of his art, whether he's reflecting them as a critique, well, that's really something that Boyd knows. And, you know, I think left-wingers and people who don't like this new politics could see Boyd's work as a critique, even if they, and I know some do see it that way. So, I mean, you know, I think Boyd is very complex, and I obviously can't speak for him. I do know that he's a very complex person. He's a very nice person, actually, when you, on a one-to-one basis with him, but when you hang out with him, he's actually quite a friendly guy and quite a loyal friend. But, you know, look, he does have falling outs with people, and at the moment we're not on speaking terms, and I don't want to go into why, but, I hope one day that changes, because I'm a huge fan of his work, and I think he's one of the most important, musician, provocateur people within the arts of the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, no, myself as well. And I think that kind of applies in some ways to Robert and I, too, where we definitely are exploring these ideas, but our emphasis, I think we consider ourselves journalists for sure, but we also both consider ourselves artists and writers, and that kind of does take a precedent over, you know, direct political action.
You reach a lot more people because politics has an alienating effect, so there might be someone who would disagree with you or be outright hostile if you make a political argument, but you can reach them through your artistic or cultural message.
Yeah, and I think I should say this about myself, and that some people who sometimes wish to protest me. I mean, you know, I'm not an overtly political person in the sense I'm not a member of a political party. I'm not running for government. My work and the things that I make in my own films and the things I reflect in the festival sometimes, or some of my political statements online or whatever, you know, and also my writings at Affirmative Right, I mean, these are more to be seen from an artistic perspective. And I say to my left-wing friends, well, see me more as like, you know, the canary in the coal mine or whatever, who's, you know, like, if you're worried about it, well, you know, I'll tell you what's going on in that community. You know what I mean? Because I've immersed myself in it. And if you want to understand something, you need to see it from the inside. And I think that's one of the great things that the new left don't understand at all. And this is why there's no interesting dialogue. I always say a number of left-wing people have kept me on as friends. For example, I have a Bernie Sanders supporter, Charles Pignon, on Facebook. He never deletes me, and I know people have asked him to delete me off his page, and I'll present the new right position, but he's always quite open to discussion. And for example, the recent Kavanaugh thing, it was all about the sex scandal. Now, he argued against Kavanaugh from the policies that Kavanaugh supports, obviously the anti-abortion stance, you know, the pro-choice, position and stuff. So he argued against Kavanaugh actually from his politics. And I said, well, that is actually what the left should be doing. They shouldn't be screaming and yelling about these, you know,
yeah, because that's what happened is, I think it is very important. The main thing, people focus exclusively on the sex scandal, but we never had a chance to have an open discussion about where does he actually stand on the important issues.
They did Trump a huge favor, and I think Trump is a genius. And people always say Trump is stupid. I mean, he plays these people like a harp. He gets them to go so low that they just look terrible. I mean, I think the GOP, you know, were looking a bit funny in the November, you know. Steve Bannon had said that in the 60 Minutes interview. But I think after that show with Kavanaugh, I think many of my left-wing friends will go, that was terrible. I mean, this guy was clearly not. like Pence. The idea that Pence is running around going to sex parties, give me a break. The guy, you know, he goes out with his wife in public. You know, because, you know, like, he's like old school, mate. You know, he's like from Gilead. He's not from, he's not from, like, you know, I don't know, whatever the wild party scene is. You know, he's a conservative, Republican. And I think Kavanaugh was very much the same. And they really shot themselves in the foot with this ridiculous Stalinist show trial that they attempted.
Yeah, no, I tend to think that what they ended up doing is probably, this Kavanaugh moment is probably the most united, you know, the various disparate different right-wing groups have been against the Democratic Party since Trump was elected. I mean, because there's been a lot of infighting, but now I think a lot of people are going to go out and vote in November.
Yeah, exactly, they will. And I think that, you know, Richard Spencer with his whole Unite the Right thing that was meant to be Charlottesburg, that was very divisive. That did the exact opposite. But we can thank Schumer, Feinstein, probably even George Soros. Thanks, guys. You know, for you really uniting the right. You know, I mean, Richard Spencer couldn't do it, but it seems like the globalists can. So we'd like to send a big thank you out to them, because now we're going to have victories in November. And thank you, George Soros. And what a great job. Just keep up your good work, you know. We'll take over the world. Right? We'll take over the world, that's right.
Matt, do you want to comment on what do you kind of do you want to tell our audience about our upcoming projects, or should we keep that a secret?
You talk about your upcoming projects.
I guess if
Let's tell Richard about them. And I think by the time we'll have the block one up soon anyway.
Okay, I guess if we want to, I'll plug some of our upcoming projects. So we have one with David Cole and L.A. Malls, and then we have another one with sex therapist Susan Block.
That's fantastic.
Have you heard of Susan Block?
No, I haven't. Who's she?
So this one should be interesting. It kind of has to be seen to be believed in some ways. She is a very left-wing sex therapist based out of L.A. who used to have a very popular or fairly popular cable access TV show. And she again is very liberal, but not necessarily always completely politically correct, in that she's willing to talk about just about anything, and do so in a very flashy and kind of shocking way. And Robin and I interviewed her about the incel issue, so that's one of our upcoming projects.
Well, I think that's really interesting. I mean, did you see the what was the name of that debate? It was with I think it was called the Monk Debate, with Jordan Peterson and Stephen Fry. And Stephen Fry was standing side by side with Jordan Peterson. Now, Stephen Fry is actually a left-winger. He's actually, I wouldn't say he's a social justice warrior, but he's maybe halfway there. And but he really dislikes political correctness. And I think there's a lot of people who dislike political correctness. And, I think the two left-wing filmmakers who are supplying films for this year's MUFF, Bruce LaBruce, is giving us his new film. He's one of the world's, premier lesbian and gay independent filmmakers. He's giving us his new film, Ulrika's Brain. Mm-hmm. I think it's a sign of solidarity a little bit to the festival, in the sense that he doesn't agree with my politics. I know he dislikes it, but I think he agrees people can have whatever ideas they like, and that obviously I've played his work in the past, and the idea that I'm homophobic, well, I've been a supporter of many, many films from the LGBT community, and I continue to do that. And I think that, when I contacted him and told him about the controversy, he was very gracious, and also to give us his new work. And so was Terry McMahon, who's another left-wing, quite bolshy guy, who's a great independent filmmaker from Ireland. He's very similar, old left, but he was happy to give us his new short as well. So, I think the idea, and, he doesn't like political correctness. For example, during the yes and no vote on abortion, he didn't argue the no vote, but he just questioned the yes a little bit, and he got into a lot of trouble for that, even though he's left.
Yeah, that's, like, with the whole gay marriage thing, it's not so much about being tolerant of gays, is about this kind of forced consensus, like where it's enforced and you have to agree. Because, I'm the same way as you. I'm actually probably more liberal on these issues than most people. Yeah,
I'm interested in libertarianism. I say I have problems with economic libertarianism. I have an essay on affirmative right called "Economic Libertarianism is Plutocratic Collectivism." You can go look at that under my name on affirmative right, but. As far as social libertarianism, in relation to when people, adults, if they want to, do whatever they like in the privacy of their own homes, a bit like Clint Eastwood, I think, that's their business, and let's just leave it alone. As long as it's consensual, and as long as they aren't hurting children, I don't have a problem with it. So, I think that's a good position to have. And so I am something of a social libertarian, and I am interested in libertarian ideas. I'm interested in even some aspects of libertarian economics. It's probably not the way that it's a free-for-all for multi-billionaires and mass corporations to go wherever, to go to a country where they can pay a dollar a day, when they used to pay decent wages in Western countries. And, there are just many ways we could improve this world, and I think outsourcing is not one of them. So, think your left-wingers see a kind of interesting connection here. And I've always said to my old left friends, can imagine if the left and right actually united. Can imagine if we sat down and, worked out issues in relation to immigration and economics, and we had a kind of middle ground, and we would win every single election in every single country around the world, and I think we would achieve great results. So I say this to my more like-minded, or at least open-minded is a better way to put it, open-minded left-wing friends, and I think some of them are quite open to the idea. I don't like division. One of the what's called the globalist, or in a Marxist sense, bourgeoisie elite, is the old idea of divide and conquer. And you see it everywhere in gender politics, sexual politics, racial politics. It's all about dividing. It's all about hating, blah, 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 blah. What if we actually united and went after these people who are fucking dividing us? You know, I mean, that's actually a Marxist concept, really. Or, and it could also be considered the concept of the new right. So, I think this is really interesting. So, and that's why I love to keep these kind of dialogue. And really, at MUF, we have all different kinds of ideas, all different kinds of filmmakers, and that's what the festival's always been about. And just because of my own personal politics occasionally leans new right, it's so fucking what, you know?
Really great just to have that you can have so much political and cultural diversity within MUF, people from different sides of the political angle, because there's so much divisiveness. And all these political events and cultural events in Hollywood and political scenes are basically becoming echo chambers, so it's great having...
No, it is.
Yeah, different political ideas and different cultural ideas, and that's actually what makes people. That's basically what leads to innovation, because when you have an open exchange of ideas, then you advance forward.
Yes, exactly. No, I mean I got deleted from the pages of a few left-wing people who run film, like Mitch Davis from the Fantastic Film Festival in Canada and Tim Lee. I think they were Bernie supporters or whatever, or maybe they were Hillary supporters, I can't remember. But, you know, as soon as I even began to promote Trump, I didn't go any more radical than say, well, I actually think Trump's interesting. You know, basically they just turned on me and deleted me from their Facebook. I think some have even blocked me like that. I don't want to single those two out. There are about 10 or 15 people like that. I found that sad because... Marcus Westbury was another one. He's a local left-wing arts guru who gets all the government funding to do whatever the hell he likes. So I think that was sad, the way that happens. I think we should leave these discussions open. And then, you know, when you enter an echo chamber, I mean, I'm still friends with some of these left-wingers, and they all just agree. Every single post is agree, agree, agree. And that's boring when it's on my page. I get that a bit too on my page, when it's just always right-wingers going, oh, yeah, great idea, Rich. I mean, I love it when the occasional left-winger chimes in with, you know what, you know, think about what you're saying, or blah, 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 and questions, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, it's not all about supply.
No, exactly. It's about debate, and it's about, testing the mettle of one's ideas with the opposition, and I think we should continue to invite, you know, our friends of opposite politics to our dinner parties, and I know I do that at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, if we're bringing out Michael Tolkien for Frankhausen's festival, I know, for example, he's anti-Trump, and he's quite left-wing, and, you know, he remains a friend of mine on Facebook, and we talk different ideas, and I know I've, you know, put some Trump stuff on his threads, and we've argued a little bit, and, you know, he sees that as healthy. I mean... And I think it is healthy, and I think that's what, you know, Jordan Peterson and Stephen Fry were trying to say in the Monk debate, which is a really excellent debate I can recommend to you. I love Jordan Peterson, by the way. I'm a real believer that the new right is a broad church, and that we can have everybody in it, from Jordan Peterson to radical, you know, Richard Spencer to, I don't know, all across the spectrum. And we should also invite left-wing people to participate in dialogues with us.
Yeah, I agree. There's a sense with your festival that I would also... I always root this back to Adam Parfrey and Apocalypse Culture, too, where it's not only is it, like, radically pro-free speech, but it's also this almost this sense, like, all these ideas should be explored, and they should be put side by side, and that we can... Not that there's a real... Not that you necessarily think of it as, like, humanitarian, but there's almost this sense, like, that is how we can... you know, improve and become more united as a society by kind of exercising these healthy... Because at the end of the day, these all correspond to just, you know, urges we have or realms of thought that we can't, you know, resist having one or the other. So it's all worth exploring.
There are times within my own work, for example, Pearls Before Swine has a kind of misanthropic quality, but I think within MUF I have a kind of humanistic quality of wanting to hear different voices, and I've always been about, you know, I mean... Every film festival in Australia talks about diversity, but all the films are politically correct. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
If there's something politically incorrect, they don't play it. So that's not really about diversity, in my view. So, you know, I mean, it's funny that the festival that they say, you know, oh, you know, that's the you know, they critique me, but, you know, as far as ideas-wise, it's actually rather diverse. So I think that's hypocritical and stupid, and, you know, I think that's one of the reasons MUF is valuable. And, You know, we've got a great selection of films. I mean, if you want a good article about the recent controversy at MUFF, David Cole, who I know you've interviewed, Robert, wrote it for Taki magazine. It's called, I think it's called, it's a David, just look, Google my name, Taki, and David Cole's name. It's on Taki magazine.
Yeah, we'll definitely link to that. So our David Cole documentary, that's going to be a series of interviews with him at various LA malls.
I'm a big fan of him, and Edwin David, who's always on his podcasts, he gave us the film The Mentors. He's a big punk fan. He secured this film with this documentary on The Mentors that we're playing this year. And we have a lot of interesting films, local films like The Decadent and Depraved, a multicultural film called Ek Asher, Corazon de Cuba, which is a fascinating project, amazing selection of shorts, and, of course, Opening Night, Purgatory Road by Mark Savage. So we have a really great selection of films.
So, Richard, what are the official opening and closing dates, and what is the information with the entire list of films for the audience to view?
The festival opens Friday, October 16. The venue is we've had to get a venue in Moorabbin, which is a studio space we've had to hire, because a couple of the MUFF venues we've used in the past were kind of doxxed by the social justice warriors. But we found a studio space that's in the suburbs, which is owned by someone who's a radical free speech advocate. So the address for that is 26 to 28 Roberna Street, Moorabbin. So that's the main venue for MUFF for the first 4 days. And then we're using the Colonial Hotel in the CBD in the city for the shorts program and the Mentors documentary. And then we're back to Moorabbin for the kind of new right night, which is the Bannon film, Your Film, and the Lawrence Southern film, and then the closing night double feature, which is the new film from Bruce LaBruce and the new film from Mike Retta, and also a short called Sacrificial Virgins, which is a kind of one of these anti-vax films. I don't even particularly agree with the anti-vax movement, but I do believe I have a right to freedom of speech, which is one of the reasons I sometimes play documentaries like that. I don't think these things should be excluded, so I play them and just let people make up their own mind. And that's where we're at, boys. So it's coming up soon. If you want the website, go to muff19.com.au. The actual full MUFF website, which is muff.com.au, that's having a bit of a problem at the moment. We've got some, I don't know whether someone's hacked it or we've just got some problem getting into it, but that should be updated in the next 48 hours as well. But I know the full program is online right now at www.muff19.com. So check it out, and if you're in Australia, come along, and we'll be doing some podcasts live, and we've even spoken to Team Bannon about maybe doing an introduction and maybe doing some live podcasting through his network, so that'd be great.
Fantastic.
Excellent. Richard Wollstonecroft, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on. And really, it would be really great if Matt and I could be there.
Well, you know, put in for a grant, or maybe there's a rich new right, someone up there who'd fly you down. So this is a call to fund the U2 to fly down under. It only cost about $4,000 or $5,000. I think
you get put a down quite sponsor so Matt and Robert can get their supply.
That's right. I'd love to have you. I'd love to host you boys down there. I hope you could make it. So see how you go. All right. It's been great talking today, and thank you for talking about the festival, and thank you for giving us your film.
Sure thing. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Take care.
All right, boys. Have fun. All right. Great talking. Cheers.
Cheers.